What we need is a decentralized model of AI based on blockchain. Decentralize the hardware through DPIN, physical infrastructure. Centralize the large language models, and where there's transparency and open governance. Decentralize the data, decentralize the application, and create a whole new paradigm of open AI. That's something worth fighting for.
This episode of Encrypted is sponsored by the HBAR Foundation. The HBAR Foundation cultivates vibrant economies and ecosystems on the Hedera network by providing financial, community, and marketing support for projects, attracting millions of users and billions of dollars to the ecosystem.
Welcome to the Encrypted Podcast, your gateway to the future of technology and innovation, right here in the heart of Dubai's dynamic tech universe. I'm your host, Maria Vovchok, and together with Dubai Blockchain Center, we are embarking on a journey that unravels the minds of tech visionaries through the digital frontiers that are shaping our world. Hello and welcome everyone to the Encrypted Podcast. I'm your host, Maria Vovchok, and today we're really happy to have here Don Tapscott, Executive Chairman of the Blockchain Research Institute, one of the world's leading authorities on the impact of technology on business and society. He has authored 16 books, including Wikinomics, How Mass Collaboration Changes Everything, which has been translated into over 25 languages. In 2016, with his son Alex, he co-authored the global bestseller Blockchain Revolution, How the Technology Behind Bitcoin and Other Cryptocurrencies is Changing the World. Now it is translated into 20 languages. In 2017, Don and Alex co-founded the Blockchain Research Institute, whose 100 plus projects are the definite investigation into blockchain strategy, use cases, implementation challenges, and organizational transformation. Don is a member of the Order of Canada, and in 2019, then ranked as the second most influential management thinker by Thinkers 50, joined Professor Christensen, Michael Porter, Peter Drucker, and others in the Thinker 50's Hall of Fame. He is an adjunct professor at INSEAD and Chancellor Emeritus of Trent University in Ontario, where he served as Chancellor in 2013 and 2019. Don, it's so impressive. You have such an amazing, impressive background. What else do you believe our audience should know about you that maybe I haven't mentioned yet?
Well, that sounds like an amazing guy, whoever that is.
Well, of course, it's you. And we're so happy that you joined our podcast.
Well, I'm happy to be here. And it's really great to meet you as well.
Likewise.
You know, I've been at this a long time. I wrote a couple of books in the 1980s.
Not just a couple.
Well, there were two in the 80s. Nobody read them. Mm-hmm. They were like studies in bad timing. Mm-hmm. Back then, you know, in 1982, I was arguing that everybody's going to use a computer connected to a vast network of networks, doing things like electronic mail and managing our time and texting and so on. And it's a funny thing, you know, the reason people said this will never happen.
At that time in the 80s.
Yeah, you'd never guess it. They said, well, I'm not going to do that ever because managers will never learn to type.
Really?
Yeah. Do I look like a secretary to you, Don? I mean, that's what people would say to me. And of course, it wasn't just about learning to type. It was like the idea of using tools like this was messing with gender roles and the workforce and the structure and management and different classes and so on. Of course, everybody types now with their thumbs, and pretty soon they won't have to type either. They just talk it or think it.
So what made you in the 80s already see the things that other wouldn't see and would not even couldn't have predicted at the time?
Well, I think it's central to my life has been research. I've always had a big research operation. I'm not smart enough to come up with the next big thing, so I have a think tank that does. And then we do a big research project. We've done probably 15 of these multi-million dollar projects over the year, and each of them tends to generate a book.
No, I'll tell you, like, you're just being modest, because the things that you already saw at that time and the things that you researched, just quick question, what moved you to be a researcher at that time?
You want to know the truth?
Yes, of course. always?
I was a psychologist as a young person, not practicing, but my expertise was in research methodology.
Okay.
And I moved to Toronto. I was in Edmonton, Alberta.
Oh, I see.
Ukrainian capital of Canada.
Amazing.
And I had two job opportunities. Mm-hmm. One was to do IQ testing in the school board for kids, and the other was to run a group at Canada's Bell Labs trying to figure out how computers connected to a bunch of networks would change the nature of work, the nature of business, and the design of organizations.
And it was in?
That was 78. Mm-hmm. And I didn't get the school psychologist job. It's funny, how just a fluke like that can totally change your life. But luck, as they say, is the intersection of preparation and opportunity.
Yeah.
And I was prepared as a researcher, not as a technologist. I picked all that up. And I got lucky because an opportunity came along. And what we did back then was we had a group of 50 people that we built the equivalent of Microsoft Office for them in 78.
Oh my God.
And so, and then there was a group using papers and pens and typing pools and and secretaries and all of that. And we gave the group, the test group, electronic mail, word processing, financial planning tools, presentation tools, personal time management, database, diaries. And that was 20 years before Office existed, built it on a Unix system. And the group that had the technology performed better, but the main thing that happened was they communicated differently. So I figured computers are not just going to be for processing data, they're going to become a communications tool. And of course that happened.
Yeah, and after that?
What did I do after that?
Yes, because
well, I took
there's
a dozen,
so many things that
I took a dozen people from there and I set up my own company in 82. And it was called Trigon for the convergence of computing, telecommunications, and content. And what we said for each of those technologies, there's an industry, the computer industry, the telcos, the communication industry, and all the content providers, the publishers, the database providers, and so on. We said, these will all come together into the middle, into something called Networked Interactive Multimedia, NIM. Turns out the word internet was a better word a little later on.
So you were, let's say, at the beginning of internet creation, and you were also working on that. I believe that our audience before already everybody knew you in 2016, and we'll talk about this just in just a minute. But I would definitely would like to learn more about your life from the perspective of a researcher and as well somebody who was so passionate about technology from this perspective. So what was after that? Like, let's say, when did you hear for the first time about blockchain technology, and how? What specific thing led you to learning and researching about that more deeply?
Well, that was 30 years later or more. But I was doing a big research project. It was inspired by the World Economic Forum, actually. And I've been going to Davos for many years. And Klaus Schwab, a great leader, head of the World Economic Forum, was very curious about how multi-stakeholder networks, new models involving companies, NGOs, and corporations could come together using networks to solve global problems and to govern. And I was wondering, what are all the things that need governance in the world that states don't do a good job of? And I wondered, how about Bitcoin? This is 2013, 14. And I was sitting with my son Alex, who was an investment banker, at a father-son ski trip over a very...
In Davos.
This was in Canada, actually. And he said, well, Bitcoin, I'm interested in that too, because I'm starting to get deal flow. So I asked him if he would write a paper for our research project about how we could govern Bitcoin. And that paper took off, because Bitcoin was a mess back then. And my publisher got wind of it and said, is this a book? So I thought about it, and then I sat down with Alex, and I said, you want to quit your big, fancy, high-paying job and come with me for $0 and write a book? And I said, as your dad, I can't advise you whether or not that's a good idea. And he thought about it, and he said, let's do it. Mm-hmm. So we wrote the book, and it turned out to be the big book that that changed the world thinking about Bitcoin. And now they started thinking about blockchain.
Yeah, as I said earlier, it was a bestseller, and it attracted so many people's attention, all around the world. And one of the things, it was after that you gave very, your famous TED Talk it was back in 2016, How the Blockchain is Changing Money in Businesses. And it got more than 10 million views. And you spoke actually there about five transformations from a prosperous world using blockchain technology, about the remittance ripoff, et cetera, et cetera. Now, let's say 8 years after that, how accurate were your predictions?
Well, the talk holds up well. I mean, thousands of people watch it every day. Yeah. New people watch it every day, still 8 years later.
I entered crypto in 2017, and one of the things that I watched first and everybody spoke about was your tech talk and your book, obviously.
You know, I wish I had $100 for everybody who told me that
this
week
case.
In Dubai.
Oh, by the way.
Hey, Don Dabscott, you made me quit my job.
But can you imagine in this case, how many people have you influenced with your speech?
Yeah. Well, it was, it held up well.
So I
heard from someone at TED that it's the most watched TED Talk, not just on blockchain, but any technology ever.
Oh my God, fantastic.
So that's kind of cool.
That's amazing. And that's really impressive.
How did it hold up? I mean, all those things are happening. But since that talk, there's been a really big change.
Yeah, and this is what I wanted actually you to compare, because you spoke, as I mentioned, about five transformations for world becoming prosperous using blockchain. And right now, 8 years later, what do you believe was the most accurate within those predictions, and which ones, you've been changing your mind, or you can see the world as hasn't been so open to that as of yet?
Well, they're all happening. I mean, I talked about the remittance ripoff, $1 trillion, where people have left their ancestral homeland, they send money back home, and they get charged 12% by Western Union or something like that. There should be no cross-border payment or fees. There's no cross-border email exchange. Okay. And this is about an internet value. And what I said in the talk is, for 40 years, we've had an internet of information. But if I send you some information, maybe a clip of this interview, I'm actually sending you a copy. You know, the person who sends it has the original. Mm-hmm. And that works great for information, but when it comes to assets, things of value like money, securities, intellectual property, the data in our identities, art, music, votes an asset, something of value that belongs to somebody, sending a copy of those is not a good idea. You don't want someone copying your identity or your vote. And if I send you $1,000, it's really important I don't still have the money.
Yes.
So I defined it back then, and this is with Alex, we figured this out, that we're moving from an internet of information to an internet of value, where anything of value, any asset, can be transacted, managed, communicated peer-to-peer. And trust is not achieved by a middleman. It's achieved by cryptography and collaboration and some clever code. So remittances have not taken off the way that we hoped they would. And many of the other applications have been slow. And there's two reasons for that. One is, and I've never really said this on TV before, so I will, I'll tell you a story. Consensus in 2017 in New York, 7,000 people. I gave the opening talk. And then I interviewed Fred Smith, the founder of FedEx, the great visionary, and his CIO, Rob Carter. And they were saying on the stage that this is going to take a while. And the way Fred described it is, you know, back in the day, we'd come up with a new idea, chain of custody for an asset. Then we'd build a system, we'd stick our logo on it, we'd go out to market, we'd dominate the industry for decades. He says, you can't do that now. We think the blockchain is going to transform our supply chains, but you can't just do it. You got to get an entire supply chain to come together and do it. You need standards. You know, what is a bill of lading, for example? So he says, this is going to take a while. And some of the delays on many of these things, people interpret it that this is not important or it's not happening. And it's the opposite. It's because it's so important that it's taking a while. The Internet of Information was just messing with the information industries. So, you know, book retailers got hit and newspapers got hit and traditional broadcasters got hit by the Internet and so on. But this is dealing with everything, every industry, and the key assets that are the foundation of our economy. The second reason, and this is very interesting, about why things have been slow, is the model of blockchain was wrong for the whole period. You know, and I wish in 2016 I could have warned people that this was going to happen, because the reason I should have known is it happened with the Internet of Information. Now, you may not know this, but back in the early 90s, when the Internet and the web was coming out, enterprises would say, well, we're not using that thing. It's not enterprise ready. It's not robust, and it's not secure, and there's bad actors and criminals and porn and all kinds of terrible things. So we're going to build our own proprietary intranets within our organization. They didn't work. And eventually, they adopted the public infrastructure. And we've gone through the same process with blockchain. Companies were building proprietary permissioned blockchains within their companies. And it was dumb. And now, of course, everybody's embracing the public infrastructure. And that's why things are really picking up and starting to happen now. The other thing that something that's very important about this whole industry. You know, I heard an interview just a couple of days ago on TV where someone was saying gold is the real important asset. And someone defending Bitcoin was saying, no, Bitcoin is digital gold and it's a better, and it was back and forth and back and forth. And I kind of wish, I was thinking, geez, I wish Alex was on the one being interviewed or debating this because, or me, because people think about crypto as an asset, something you invest in, hopefully goes up. There's bad actors, speculators. No, this is about the digitization of all assets. I mean, sure, one type of asset is money or a currency, but there are other types, securities. Yeah. How about intellectual property? How about contracts and deeds? How about our identity, you know? How about a carbon credit? That's an asset. Or for that matter, how about a barrel of oil, which is something that can be tokenized? You don't put the barrel of oil in the token, but you put all the data that represents the barrel and describes its movement through a supply chain. So this is a foundation for a whole new economy. Mm-hmm. It's a foundation for profound changes to the deep structure and architecture of the corporation, of how we orchestrate capability in society to innovate, to create goods and services. And it's not just something you buy that you hope goes up. This is, you know, the elephant in the blindfolded person. Somebody's looking at the tail and thinking, this is a tail. They're not even looking at the tail, they're looking at a hair on the tail, because this whole thing is much bigger.
Hedera is the most used, sustainable, public distributed ledger in the world. These are just a few of the game-changing applications built on Hedera, which is governed by the world's leading organizations and fueled by HBAR, the world's greenest cryptocurrency. What future will you build?
over like 16 widely known books. If I'm not mistaken, there were even 20, because you mentioned there were like some in the 80s. Which one, so I believe that you're trying to cover all of this picture that we're discussing, mm-hmm. but I'm still curious, among all of these books, which one so far is the most challenging, you find the most challenging was to write and to publish and to release, and why?
Oh boy. See, every one of them, there's been big pushback mm-hmm. when I first wrote it. But I don't know, I'll mention one that was challenging and one that was probably the most fun. Challenging was in the 1990s, I started noticing how my own children were effortlessly able to use all this sophisticated technology. Mm-hmm. Now, first I thought, my children are prodigies. They're geniuses. And then I noticed that all their friends were like them, so that was a bad theory. So I started working with a group of kids. Got a project manager, and she interviewed and talked to all these kids, 300 kids, mm-hmm. and I wrote the book Growing Up Digital.
Oh,
and it was the first
Growing Up Digital.
Yeah, it was the first big seller about the millennials, really. And I said, this is the first generation to come of age in the digital age, and these kids are different.
Yeah.
In fact, this is the first time in human history when children are an authority about something really important. You know, I said in the book, when I was 11, I was an authority on model trains. Mm-hmm. Today, the 11-year-old at the breakfast table is an authority on this digital revolution that's changing every institution in society. Mm-hmm. So rather than a generation gap, big differences between kids and parents over values, lifestyle, ideology. I mean, my parents didn't even like the Beatles, let alone the Doors or the Rolling Stones or something. That doesn't exist. Kids and parents get along pretty well. Mm-hmm. We have a generation lap mm-hmm. where kids are lapping their parents on the digital track. So that was really a fun thing to do. And then a decade later, we interviewed or surveyed 11,000 people in 10 countries. Mm-hmm. So there was Growing Up Digital, and then a decade later, Grown Up Digital, because they were, this is your generation coming mm-hmm. into the workforce, into the marketplace, into society. And people either loved that book or they hated it. Yeah, they were really threatened by the idea that kids would know more than adults about something important. So, I mean, just a couple of other things. I wrote one of my best books, had terrible timing. It was a
Which
book
is?
Called Digital Capital.
It
got the best reviews of any book I've ever written. Business Week, that was the big reviewer back then, the last two words of the review were pure enlightenment. That's what they just, the book came out the month NASDAQ crashed, the dot-coms crashed, and nobody wanted to hear about the internet. So life is hard. And I think the most fun book to write was Blockchain Revolution, because I did it with Alex. And after a while, I mean, we share some DNA and a kind of big experience. Someone, Alex said, yes, I've known Don a long time. Mm-hmm.
You mean your son?
Yeah. So we start completing each other's sentences. You know, it was kind of by the end, it was, yeah, this chapter on financial services, the seven things that banks do. And Alex would say, yeah, I know what you mean. I think there's an eighth. And I'm like, right, so what did we do? And Alex says, well, let me go away. I've already started thinking about it. You know, it would be that kind of fun conversation.
By the way, talking about blockchain technology, you talked in it about Web3 and how blockchain AI and the Internet of Things and extended reality are coming together.
Yeah.
So what do you mean by that, and how it is changing things right now,
okay,
from your perspective?
Well, Web3.
A new era.
It's a new era. It's another way of looking at all this, mm-hmm. honestly. The original way in Blockchain Revolution, Internet of Information, yeah, becoming an Internet of Value. The Web3 is for the first web up until the year 2000. The internet was a platform for the presentation of content. You go to the web. And in computer science language, it's called the read web. You could access it. Then around 2000, we saw the rise of XML and technologies like that. The internet became a platform for collaboration. You could read and write to the web. You can go onto Wikipedia, make an entry. You could go into social media and comment. In some ways, it was a platform not for presentation, but for computation. But all of our data was captured by a new species of business. We called them a digital conglomerate.
Google, digital conglomerate.
Yeah, Google, Apple. Mm-hmm. A term that's never taken off, but I love the term because these companies, Amazon, Facebook, they can rapidly evolve into adjacent or even not so adjacent business because they own the asset of the digital age, mm-hmm. which is data. So they capture our data. And that's a big problem, which I'd be happy to talk about why. But the new web, enabled by blockchain, is the read-write-own web, where you get to own the assets and the data that you create. So that's an extraordinary thing. Now, when you think about that, that changes all of the technologies of our era. So AI, the Internet of Things, and extended reality. Like right now, the model of AI is wrong. It's centralized, and it's a you don't write to AI. you write to it, but it captures all your data and you don't own it, right?
And it's later uses to produce the content it
yeah,
generates.
That's right, exactly. And it's opaque. You don't know what the algorithms are underneath. It's owned by huge corporations, mm-hmm. and it's centralized. Mm-hmm. And that's a big problem because people worried about all kinds of things about AI. One of them is that we lose our human agency. You know, mm-hmm. 10 years from now, these AIs will look at us and they'll look at us like we look at a little chipmunk or a mouse or something in terms of intelligence. So what we need is a decentralized model of AI based on blockchain. Decentralize the hardware through DPIN, physical infrastructure. Centralize the large language models, and where there's transparency and open governance. Decentralize the data, decentralize the application, and create a whole new paradigm of open AI. That's something worth fighting for. Internet of Things, same thing. It's not going to go through a central server. If that, you know, light buys some power from a distributed power source and it promptly pays the power source, which enhances its reputation as a trustworthy device, that's not going to go through Visa. Mm-hmm. Okay, you need a blockchain for that. And the same is true for extended reality. You know, these virtual worlds, you go to Mark Zuckerberg's Meta, mm-hmm. and this is the model. It's kind of like Alex said in his new book, Web3. He says it's like Disney World. You know, you go there, but they set all the rules. They harness all the value. We need a decentralized model of the mm-hmm. metaverse where we create the rules. There's community governance where you create value, you get to own the value. Mm-hmm. There's a native currency and so on. So all of these things are not separate technologies. They're coming together, and blockchain's critical to all of them in our view.
So when we're talking about five transformational powers in your speech, I would like to focus specifically on monetizing the data. Because there was a very interesting point that you mentioned, like how blockchain in this case can be transformative and making personal data truly private and monetizable, especially when we, let's say, talking about content creators.
Yeah.
So when you mentioned Facebook, for example, one of the biggest social media platforms, tech giant, and I heard over the last couple of years how there's a lot of alternatives, decentralized social media platforms. Yeah. They're trying to, let's say, yeah. overtake Facebook, potentially maybe Twitter,
yeah.
although from this perspective, what do you believe should they be overtaken, Twitter, Facebook, replaced in the future by decentralized models of social media, it's one thing, and how in this case content creators will be able to own their data and monetize it.
Well, first of all, content creators, we are all content creators. You create a virtual Maria as you go throughout life. You leave a trail of digital crumbs, not just on social media, but every time you go somewhere, GPS, every time you buy something, you know. And the virtual you knows more about you than you do, because you can't remember what diagnosis you had a year ago, or what medication you took, or what you got on a test, or who you interviewed, or, you know, your exact location. And that virtual you gets captured by these digital conglomerates. Mm-hmm. So fair enough. I mean, it means you can't monetize the data. They do, and they become the wealthiest corporations ever. You know, a guy named Jared Lanier said there's 1.5 billion people in the world who could double their income if they could monetize their data. But there are other problems too. It means you can't use the data to plan your life. It means that the data is not secure. I mean, there are two types of these central servers that this stuff sits on. Those that have been hacked and those that will be hacked.
Yeah.
And it means that you can't anonymize that data and donate it, give it to science, or maybe it could be aggregated for social purposes, like, say, stop a pandemic. And it also means that your privacy is being undermined. You know, and I travel around, people say to me, well, Don, privacy's dead, get over it. This is foolishness. Excuse me, because privacy is the foundation of freedom. And all this data is the stuff of our identities, and we need to get this data back so that we can manage it responsibly for ourselves and benefit from it, including monetization. So that means that we need a self-sovereign identity that sweeps up this data on a blockchain into you. And then, here's the cool thing. It's not just an identity made of data, though. You bundle in AI, and your virtual Maria becomes smart, becomes your co-pilot, your digital
twin.
Persona. Well, yeah, digital twin, that word is going to get renamed or reused, because right now we think about a physical object, but it'll be a digital thing too. And it's going to remember every conversation you had, and it's going to help you plan what you're doing in business and help you with your purchases.
Learn faster.
Yeah. You're going to have to reinvent your knowledge base, and it's going to be there because it has pretty much all the knowledge in the world. It's really smart. I mean, everything. If you're dating, you know, you're not going to go onto some app. It's going to have 1,000 dates with a bunch of other virtual personas and come back with some really sound recommendations for someone to have lunch with. So, and this is not futuristic. This is all rolling out right now.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of elliptical to your main point question, which is, well, how do we get there? And like, everyone's still using the traditional stuff. And we've all made this kind of Faustian deal where, you know, we'll give away our data in exchange for all this good stuff that we get. And there are two ways that something like that gets changed over history and in society. One is that people begin to understand that the deal's not a good one.
Mm-hmm.
And it's worth the switching costs to go to something else, because my data is just too important to me, or it's too valuable to me, or if I'm going to have a digital twin, maybe I ought to control that thing and own it, not some giant corporation. And the other thing is that ultimately you get options that are just better. I was meeting with someone this morning that's building one of these Web3 platforms for social media. This thing has way better functionality than the Twitters and the Facebooks and the kind of stuff that we use today. So people look at that and they think, I'm sick of Twitter, you know, I'm sick of Facebook, and I'm looking for an alternative. I don't mind if I gotta rebuild a friend group and so on, because ultimately the functionality is better for me. When's that going to happen? I don't know. Mm-hmm. But there are the seeds of that change today.
Encrypted is your exclusive ticket to the epicenter of technological innovations in the MENA region. Actually, when we talk about the blockchain technology has a lot of benefits that it will bring to humanity, you have also spoken about the dark side of the digital revolution, and yeah. I would like to focus on that. So what are the greatest threats that are posed by blockchain, emerging tech in general, and how do you believe society can mitigate them?
Okay. Whoa. We have a few hours. I'll do the quick version.
Let's do the bullet points from.
Well, actually, I'll start with a bit of a story. This is a bit humbling. Mm-hmm. So, when I wrote The Digital Economy in '94, I was really upbeat about the web, and it's going to have all this big, powerful impact, and all of that pretty much turned out to be true. But I had this section called the dark side, where I said some things can go wrong. Mm-hmm. We may lose our privacy in an irrevocable way. Mm-hmm. Check. I said, I think the digital age is going to bring about prosperity. It always does. It's economist Schumpeter, creative destruction. You bring in a new revolution and capitalism, you know, the old systems break down, new ones get born, and things are better. Well, that happened for a while, but now we have this weird thing that's happening in many countries, like the United States, where the economy is getting bigger and the middle class is shrinking. There is wealth creation, but prosperity is declining for most people. Mm-hmm. And that's a complicated story on why that's happening, but technology's got a lot to do with that. And then I said, I think the internet's going to bring us together because we'll all have access to the same information. The truth will come forward. I said, could go the other way. People could follow false information, even if they know it's false. We could have these self-reinforcing echo chambers where the purpose of information is not to comfort us, it's to or to give us information, it's to make us feel better, you know? So, check. I said, there were seven of these things. I said, I think technology will create new jobs. It always has. I said, it could go the other way. It could come in so fast that we'll see structural unemployment. Now, so far the technology has created jobs, but you know, if you look at the US, 48 out of 50 states, the number one job type for men is truck driver. And in all states, the number one job type for women is cashier. Mm-hmm. So those are gone in a decade, you know, and then there's the Rust Belt that brought, you know, unemployment that brought Donald Trump to power. Well, the reason that there was unemployment and factories and stuff were shutting down is not because of, you know, immigrants, it's because of technology. So these are, you know, we talked about how will it affect government and democracy, it could go the other way. So these are really big problems. And I've spent the last 5 years trying to think about, well, for every one of those, we need a new kind of solution, not the old stuff, you know? So for around privacy, everyone says, well, we need government to protect our privacy. Mm-hmm. Well, we don't need protection of our own data, we need ownership. Mm-hmm. We need a self-sovereign identity, make it a smart one while you're at it. You know that. We need the problem of prosperity. It's true, there's a tiny 1% that just owns more and more. So the solution is to redistribute wealth, right? Well, let's think differently. You know, Elon Musk ought to pay some tax, but maybe we should pre-distribute wealth. Maybe we can make the economy more democratic through DAOs, and where the workers become shareholders, they become stakeholders. You don't have the shareholder-worker dichotomy.
And this is actually your emphasis of our new social contract.
Yeah. To do that, we're going to need a new social contract. Mm-hmm. You know, when we went from the agrarian age to the industrial age, we figured out stuff. We figured out people are going to need to be literate. Got to create the public education system. Mm-hmm. Create a law. Everybody's got to go to school. We figured out people live in the city. going to need a social safety net. They can't just grow some more vegetables to stay alive. We figured out you can't have one oil company owning all the oil. We conducted a whole bunch of things, created a whole bunch of deals between government, the private sector, civil society, citizens, that represented a social contract for the industrial age. Mm-hmm. I don't think we've done any of that.
So how can, in this case, blockchain help?
Well, this is one of these technologies that has, like all technologies, most technologies, has an extraordinary neutrality. It will be what we want it to be. And if it's going to be a tool for criminals and evil people to commit nefarious acts, it will be that. And if it's going to be a tool to help us create a self-sovereign identity and to change the way that the economy works by changing the relationship between producers and people who work, or the owners of wealth and those who work, by ending the remittance ripoff, for ensuring that the 70% of people in the developing world that don't have a valid title to their land, by giving them a valid title mm-hmm. that nobody can take away. You know, these are all, and there are many, many things like this that I've written about, whereby blockchain could help us build a society that's not just more just and equal, mm-hmm. but where and where we could solve problems like climate change. We need to tokenize carbon credits, mm-hmm. and we need what's called DMRV, digital reporting, measurement, and valuation, where every single thing, a cup, gets created. You can track it through the entire supply chain, right through to its disposal, and know the carbon it emits, so that the owner of that thing can offset the carbon fairly without, you know, greenwashing and saying that we're offsetting carbon. I don't think climate change can be solved without blockchain.
Mm-hmm. How can you say, with your Blockchain Research Institute, how are you contributing to that as well right now?
Well, we've done 160 projects.
Fantastic.
Like, I've given you information from about four of them in this interview. We've covered every industry, every use case, every problem, every challenge. We have the largest online education program in the world on blockchain, 250,000 mm-hmm. learners. It's on Coursera.
Okay, and yeah, please tell us. I think that our audience would like to know about this.
It's through INSEAD, number two business school in the mm-hmm. world, according to the FT. Mm-hmm. Harvard's number four, I think. So, and they're the Blockchain Revolution and Web3 programs, mm-hmm. Don and Alex Tapscott on Coursera. Mm-hmm. And most large companies have a Coursera subscription. You get it for free. If mm-hmm. you don't, it's like $70 mm-hmm. a month. And the first program we did, it's four full courses. It costs us almost $1 million to create. It's got 250 videos shot by a Hollywood film crew. It's got 200 tests. Mm-hmm. And you go through something like that and you get a certificate at the end saying that you've taken the full courses. Oh, the final course is a practicum uh-huh. where the learners have to come together and come up with a use case.
Interesting.
So it's crazy. And they all peer evaluate this stuff. We don't do anything. We just watch them, thousands of them, mm-hmm. sort of talking about use cases. And one thing we're doing now is, I just made an agreement to do another one yesterday, is we're doing these courses for specific industries uh-huh. or around specific topics.
Okay.
So we're doing one now on AI and blockchain.
Are you doing this in UAE?
No, that one's not being funded by a UAE organization, but there's a new one, I can't announce it yet, that will
okay.
be.
Okay, but if you may at least hint, give us a hint, so I believe our audience will be the first to know about it.
Yeah. Well, it has to do with energy, mm-hmm. and and the use of energy and the role for Web3 in solving that problem, the energy problem and the climate problem. But if anyone just goes to blockchainresearchinstitute.org, they can learn all about this. And a lot of the stuff that we've done is now, with the permission of our companies, there are like 50 huge corporations that have funded this. We're now making Creative Commons so they can get access to it. We're also in discussion, this is all I can say, about using all of this IP to create an entirely new massive organization in the region that would...
In the UAE, in the Middle Eastern region.
Yeah, well, more broadly in the Middle East.
Yes.
That would be a transformative thing.
Interesting.
Yeah, because it would bring all of this IP to everybody in the region.
So actually, I wanted to ask you more about this because you've been like not once in Dubai, and you've been speaking recently at the Future Blockchain Summit. So I'm really curious, are there more things that you could share with us that you're planning to do specifically in the UAE or in the Middle East in Dubai? And we would love to hear about that.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I've been here, yes, going back 30 years. World Economic Forum has held a whole number of events here. I've probably been to 7 or 8 of them. But when I first started about talking about blockchain here in 2016, nobody knew what I was talking about. And for a lot of people, this was a big problem. Yeah. It was 3 years ago in Qatar, I was told, don't use the word crypto. Because it's against our law. It's financial speculation. So I had a big discussion with a bunch of government leaders there that if you're going to make crypto against the law, this is not, again, about an asset. This is about the digitization of all assets. And that's the heart of an innovation economy. So you can't outlaw the innovation economy, or you're going to, you know, you better have a lot of resources forever to be able to build an economy to do that. You know, this is public, so I can say it, but the Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi had me come and give the Majlis lecture. It's an extraordinary thing. It's in a big permanent tent on the palace grounds where they had the whole leadership from the Emirates. All the political and royal leaders, and also all the business leaders, and there was a, you know, ambassadors from a dozen countries as well, and I think it was the first time they ever heard the word blockchain. Some of them, and I can't tell you what happened at the meeting, but there was interest in that. So, and then, you know, Dr. Marwan here and the blockchain, the Dubai Blockchain Center, we've collaborated with them in the early days. I think they've had a really big impact on opening up in Dubai now. You know, is starting to compete with some of the other big centers in the world, Silicon Valley, and of course China is putting tens of billions of dollars into these locations. And Silicon Valley, as Alex says, was once described as a tech Galapagos because of the really extraordinary combination of money and talent and sort of technology that was there was nothing like that anywhere in the world. But where will the Silicon Valley for the second era of the digital age be? I'm not sure it's going to be in Silicon Valley. There's still amazing stuff that's going on there. But you look at Dubai, I mean, I'm quite struck being here at the kind of innovation and kind of extraordinary things that are happening. And I'm also very gratified that people like what we're doing and think that it's helpful.
Yeah. Don, thank you so much. Right now we move to the last part of our interview. Stay tuned with Encrypted. Rapid fire questions.
If you had to explain blockchain to a child, how would you do this in one sentence?
You know, the internet, it's all about information, but it doesn't handle things of value like money.
Okay.
So we need an internet that can move stuff like money. And that would be a really wonderful thing.
Okay. Not name five qualities that you believe every entrepreneur should have.
Entrepreneur, curiosity.
Okay.
It's key. The ability to work hard.
Okay.
The ability to never give up. Mm-hmm. 90% of being an entrepreneur is things are going terrible and you just keep at it. I would be a collaborator, not a command and control leader, and I would be all about trying to be a lifelong learner, to reinvent my knowledge base.
What would you never do while building?
What would I never do?
Yes.
Run out of money.
Okay. That's a very good approach, I believe.
You have to always make payroll.
What do you believe is the biggest misconception people have about blockchain technology?
That it's an asset and it creates digital assets that you invest in and they're speculative. Maybe they'll go up, but maybe they'll go down.
Talking about assets or crypto, Bitcoin or Ethereum?
Me?
Because you spoke about both of them, so I'm curious which one right now.
Well, I think
8 years past.
Bitcoin is wonderful. The amazing thing about it is that it works.
Mm-hmm.
But Ethereum, ultimately, much more important for society because it's not just a currency, it's digital. It's a platform for new models of corporations, supply chains, and everything else.
Finish the sentence. My business philosophy is?
My business philosophy is to live a principled life of consequence.
Oh, amazing. How often do you practice your keynote speech before going on a stage?
I thought you were going to say my keyboard.
Because
I'm in a band and I just play keyboards.
Really?
I don't practice.
Oh, at all?
No. Well, I'll think about it.
And the one thing you did TED Talk 8 years. You didn't practice.
Oh, no, I did for that.
Okay.
For TED, you have exactly 18 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And if you blow 7 seconds, you really mess it up. So you got to have every word come through.
The next big trend to call tech trend.
Next big trend?
Yes.
Well, it's my next book. It's
okay.
How Web3 and AI come together to create digital identities that are smart. So you're going to have a multimodal variant. You and your digital path or persona that's going to help you build an awesome life.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's interesting. We definitely need to check it
out.
Well,
AI is going through a big change. People think you go to ChatGPT. You don't. ChatGPT is going to be part of you.
Yeah. What is your personal formula for success?
Come up with a differentiated value proposition. Don't do something everybody else is doing.
Interesting. That's really valuable piece of advice. And Dubai for you is associated with?
Innovation.
Fantastic. Today, we're really happy to have Don Tapscott, Executive Chairman of the Blockchain Research Institute, Tech Talk legend, talking about blockchain technology. Thank you so much for joining, and see you next time.
From the gleaming skyscrapers of Dubai to the innovation hubs of the Middle East and beyond, Encrypted brings you thought-provoking discussions, exclusive insights, and stories of innovation that will leave you inspired.
This episode of Encrypted is sponsored by the HBAR Foundation. The HBAR Foundation cultivates vibrant economies and ecosystems on the Hedera network by providing financial, community, and marketing support for projects, attracting millions of users and billions of dollars to the ecosystem.